like to know the rules for running a successful business? Jeff Glick will tell us how to do this. And what's so special about Jeff is he's a senior finance executive with more than 30 years of experience supporting hedge funds, private equity firms, family offices, and renewable energy ventures. And he has served as chief financial officer for Sagard Capital, Almaz USA, and several other international organizations, where he helped strengthen operations, improve governance, and guide companies toward growth and successful exits. And he's now the head of US operations for outsourced CFO. Jeff, tell us about the rules for running a successful business. What do most entrepreneurs get wrong?
Welcome to Awakened Titans Podcast with Lily Patrescu. Mind-blowing conversations with influential business titans sharing how you can manifest abundance, love, joy, success through quantum awakening, quantum manifestation, quantum healing, quantum miracles, exponential business growth, and innovative products and services.
I think an entrepreneur, they have a core competency, and that might be investing, that might be research, it might be coding, but there are a lot of things that they don't understand, nor should, about running a business. In a lot of cases, they don't know what they don't know. And to align themselves with proper people is pretty critical. And that starts from the bottom up, where you have bookkeepers, accountants, people who you trust will tell you the truth. And that's also where having a trusted advisor like a CFO is critical. Having the right people there to support you on the things that you might not have the skills to do. And it's hard at the beginning because your funds are so tight, but you need to make some investment in your infrastructure along the way. And that's one of the hardest things.
Great. So tell us about the rules for running a successful business. What, aside from having a CFO and the right accountants and people to support you, what's the blueprint and what are the rules for running a successful business?
The planning as much as you can, either planning for growth or planning for issues. I think, you know, where I want to get to this level of sales, I want to prepare my team for this product production. How are we going to get there? And you have to plan as much as you can. Planning, I think, is critical. And a lot of people, a lot of entrepreneurs, they don't spend the time to plan.
And in terms of the other rules that people should know for running a small business,
I think one of the biggest rules is being fair and honest. And so people can trust you. If people ask you a question, tell them the truth. And those people could be your investors, your employees, or your partners, or your lawyers. You have to build a level of trust where people aren't going to question everything you say. And that's also very critical. People always say, my word is my bond, and that should be for everybody.
Thank you. In terms of the numbers that every founder should know and optimize, what are the kinds of numbers that founders should plan for?
One of the biggest issues are, what's my margin? How much am I making per engagement? And a lot of times I'll ask somebody, what's your margin? And they go, overall, it's about 50%, which is pretty good. However, and then I say, how many are above 50% and how many are below 50%? And then they look at me like I have two heads because they don't have the infrastructure to say, oh, half are at 75, half are at 25. If half are at 25, you should either fire those clients or charge them more or figure out, is that margin at 25 because you have the same people working on those? And strategically, you might want to move them out to other projects, or the salesperson is undercutting your margin only just to get sales. And that is one of the areas that allocation of labor, allocation of materials, it's the boring stuff, But the boring stuff provides an entrepreneur with a strategic view of what's going on. And when they're getting to that next level where they want to do a strategic, significant financial transaction, people want to know this. And if you can't give them the numbers, that's a problem. And the other side of the coin is, how much does it cost to get a client? I guess the acronym people who throw around is CAC, cost of customer acquisition. And how are you going to do that if you don't track it? And it all goes back to knowing key elements of your business. Because what happens in marketing is, first couple of clients you have or customers, your margin is less because the cost to acquire those are so high. And then as you scale, you'll have more sales and you'll also have more marketing, but the cost per client will go down. And that's something you have to be very careful about, because now you have a better name, you have recurring sales, and so you really have to manage that as well as possible. And that gets back to, as I say, the boring stuff, the accounting and finance, and having that information available to you.
Thank you. To build a wildly profitable business, what other numbers should founders be tracking and optimizing?
So basically, it's cost of goods sold, the sales, the returns. Are people returning at a higher level than we expect? And then, so you have to go back and figure out why are the returns so high. Look at your payroll. Is it higher than it should be per some statistics? Or are you having a lot of turnover in your staff? And that's also very poor. I think a lot of the key numbers are also based on which industry you're in, because everyone is a little different, but the entrepreneur has to know the drivers of his or her business. I think that's really critical. And by going through a couple of iterations of their income statement, you start to see a trend, and you have to study them and get that trend. And that goes back to having the right people there as trusted advisors to help you walk through it.
Thank you. What's the difference between vanity metrics and decision-making metrics in a business?
Can you repeat the first one?
What's the difference between vanity metrics and
Okay.
decision-making metrics?
Vanity metrics are just, are we looking good? Do we have sales? Strategic is, what's the bottom line? Is this adding to our EBITDA? Is it adding to the value of our business? That's the really key. Yes, it's great to have more sales. Yes, it's great to have a larger number of clients, but are you losing money on them? Are you using your bank loans properly? Are certain clients taking up so much of your capital where you're actually almost losing money on them? That's the difference between of vanity and real strategic numbers.
Thank you. How does someone calculate the EBITDA numbers?
But EBITDA is earnings before interest, taxes. So basically, what you do is you take your income and you start looking at the add backs to that. So let's say I make $100. How much is that? How much did I pay in interest? How much did I pay in taxes? How much did I pay in depreciation? And so by that kind of gives you a true feeling of how much money we're either burning or making on our key elements. Because something like depreciation, that's already cash spent. That's not a annual or a day-to-day expense. So you raised money or invested money to build your infrastructure. That's where depreciation comes from. And so by taking that out, you're not weighing down your actual operations. Same thing with interest. Interest, you have a loan, that's just part of doing business. It's not the cash that is generated through your operations.
Thank you. Can a company leverage depreciation in a positive way?
The only way you could do that is with taxes, because sometimes there's accelerated depreciation that might help your tax bill in the current year. There's no really way, it's just an expense that's spread over a period of time. But on a cash basis, the only way to really to use that depreciation is based on your taxes, to reduce your taxes if accelerated depreciation is allowed on those assets.
Thank you. For companies where there is a recurring membership, what should companies be aware of?
So what you want to know is how many people, first of all, what's the growth in that number? For 1 year, we have 150,000 in recurring. Next year, we have 500. Next year, we have 1 million, and it has a nice growth. However, if you look into it deeper, how many of those are new clients and how many have we lost? So what you want to do is to reduce the losses. People might get bored of it or whatever that service is you provide. So you have to really understand what makes up the growth. Is it pure growth, or is your growth, so let's say your membership goes up 1,000 over the course of the year. Did you really add 1,250 and lose 250? Now you have to look at, from a organization standpoint, how do we reduce that 250 of losses? Do we have to add new products? Do we have to do a better job of customer service to reduce that 250 while we're increasing the new clients as well? I think that's really important. If you have the right metrics being calculated, and it's available on a timely basis.
Thank you. What measures do you recommend for companies to introduce to reduce churn? You mentioned a couple just now, but is there anything else?
It's just doing a really good job understanding what your clients want from you. You've already done the hard job. You've got that client on your platform. Now, how do you keep that client? And a lot of it is reaching out, doing questionnaires, calling them up. He says, okay, you've been with us for 2 years. What else do you need from us? And then you have to figure out, is it worth investing in those new services or that new idea to keep those clients? Or you just say, we're going to lose 20% a year. That's just the way it is, because it's going to cost us so much money to add those services to keep them.
Thank you. Is it possible for a company to run out of working capital despite being very profitable?
Absolutely. You could be very profitable, but it could cost you a lot of money to keep that, to keep the machine going. If you're in retail sales, you have to buy all the merchandise upfront. You have to ship it out, and you might have to pay to a startup company, you might have to pay upfront. But if you're selling it to a large retailer, they might have 60, 90 days. So it's really looking at the cash flows between accumulating the inventory and getting paid for it after the fact. That's just one example. The other example is what we spoke about is, okay, I'm losing 25% of my clients a year, but I'm getting new ones. However, if I want to keep those 25%, it might cost me more money in new products and in new technology than it's worth to keep those 25%. So that's something you have to look at also. Also, as you grow, you might want to get a larger office or a bigger warehouse or new machines, new machinery. That all costs money. So you really have to look at the investment up front to get larger in the next 30, 60, 90, 3 years. How are you going to fund that? And that's when you start thinking about, we need to get a Series A round or a Series B round, so we can make the investments up front, and we're not going to lose our clients because we don't have enough money to treat them like the valuable asset that they are.
Thank you. Are you saying that in most cases it's required to find investors to fund the working capital gap, or are there other measures founders can put in place to make this happen?
Sure, there are other methods. One is, if you have assets already, you can get a bank loan for it. Another way is through a partnership with a company in your field, or maybe partner with a supplier. Go out and get better terms for your merchandise that you're selling, and that supplier then becomes a quasi-partner of yours, where you're both making more money, but they just have to be a little more friendly in the terms that they offer. Another way of doing it, possibly, depending upon how big you are, is to lower the salaries of your key employees and offer them stock. That's another way I've seen that happen, where they're all in. They have the confidence in you and the team, and they're willing to make that bet on you. So that's another way to do it. You could roll back bonuses maybe and say, instead of big bonuses, we're going to give you shares. That's another way you can make it happen. Or you could do a little of this, a little of that, and work it out that way.
Thank you. What are some other acronyms or financial terms that most founders either don't know or misunderstand? And they should really know these in order to become investable or exit ready.
The key is, right, investable or bankable. So will a bank. So a couple of the important ones are, I'm not a big fan of acronyms because it can be confusing sometimes, but there's MOIC, M-O-I-C, Multiple on Invested Capital. So let's say I'm a growing company and I'm making acquisitions. What's my return on that acquisition? So let's say we are making $1 million a year, and for 3 years, we have $3 million in the bank. I just went out and I just spent $1 million to buy another company. So now, did that make sense? And after a year, I know how much our sales went up or how much they're attributable to that investment, because we also have the boring infrastructure to be able to say, this is from your new acquisition, this is from your old company, and here's the combined. And so if you're trying to do that, you say, I invested $1 million and I made $1.5 million more. And of that $1.5 million, half of that is from the acquisition. So I just repaid myself 75%. And if you do that for 2 years, so now you have a multiple of invested capital, which means I know what I'm doing. I know how to grow. I know how to invest money. And when you go out into the market to get investors, they'll see that this team knows what they're doing on how to grow.
Thank you. What does good financial infrastructure actually look like for a startup?
It means that you have at some level of policies, procedures, internal controls, that people are looking, that there's a budget, there's a financial plan, that each month someone is sitting down with that founder and saying, this is what you wanted to do, this is what you're doing, let's figure out what the difference is. And you can't do that unless you have proper books and records, that they're timely, accurate, and consistent. Those are the three things that are so important. Because if you have an issue in, let's say, in the current month, and that current month's over, if you're getting those reports in 6 to 8 weeks after that month is over, it could be too late. So what you want to do is to make the investment in proper financial reporting that is in line with the size and age of a company.
Thank you. What systems should be in place before raising capital?
So what I was saying is a lot of companies are going to look at your internal controls, everything I mentioned, and say, if you don't have that, how do I trust your numbers? And they will be taking a discount to your valuation for that. So that's really critical. But they also know that for a small business or a startup business, your value probably isn't in your infrastructure. Your main value is in your intellectual property or your IP, your patents, your methodology, your team, a lot of that. So it has to be balanced, but if they can't trust your numbers, be prepared for a drastic discount to your valuation, and that affects a lot of other things. How much money you're going to have to, or the percentage that you'll need to give away, and other things like that.
Thank you. What kind of documentation or numbers is an investor likely to ask for if you were trying to raise capital?
Depending on, let's say the company's been around for 3 to 5 years. They'll ask typically for 2 to 3 years of financial statements, which is income statement, balance sheet, cash flow on an annualized basis. Then they'll ask for the last 4 to 6 quarters. Because what they want to figure out is the income straight or is it cyclical? Is it going up and down? And how is the cash situation handling that? They'll probably also ask for your tax returns. And then they'll try to look at, or they'll reconcile your tax returns to your internal books. If they don't agree and there's no bridge or reconciliation between the two, that's an issue. And a lot of young entrepreneurs or first-time entrepreneurs, they don't know what's going on at the tax level. They sign it and they trust whoever the tax preparer is. And that's why having a part-time or fractional CFO, if they can't afford full-time, or a trusted advisor on the team to ask these hard questions and just to learn where they sit down with the tax preparer and say, okay, walk me through this and where does this differ from our internal numbers? Because people are going to start asking questions, and you'd be surprised what people ask. It gets crazy at the higher level, but they typically will ask for, then they'll ask for, on top of that, they'll ask for patent information. They'll ask for employee contracts. They'll ask for significant or material contracts with vendors, suppliers. They'll ask for your lease terms. Then they might ask additionally for your errors and omission insurance documentation, your directors and officers insurance, your slip and fall insurance, everything that's going to give them an idea of how well you're running your business and what the risks are that have not been taken into account.
Thank you. I think there are a lot of investors that are really great at buying businesses at a discount because they know how to find loopholes and how to find all the different things that entrepreneurs do wrong in order to leverage it because they are interested, but they just want to get basically the business at the cheapest possible price. So what are those like biggest problems or mistakes entrepreneurs make that cause them to sell their business at a huge discount because they didn't think of putting this or that in place?
Exactly. They're not planning for it. They're might be trusting somebody. They might have a trusted advisor in their network. This is, oh, it's worth having Sally's VC group come in. It might cost you a little extra, but it's worth it. or they might not go through the process of bringing in 3 to 5 different groups and hear what they have to say. Or they might be not concentrating on building the book to give to somebody, and there could be holes in it. Having a proper data room. People like, when they do due diligence, they like for the numbers to flow well. So it might be worth it to them to hire somebody on a short-term basis to help them create this data room where the numbers work, the numbers flow. So that's why a lot of companies, they'll do something called sell side due diligence. They'll do the due diligence on their own because they'll know what questions are coming and they'll have the answers up front. And a lot of times you can give that sell side report to the acquiring funds, and that might make it easier for their due diligence. And you're kind of leading them to where the issues that you know, and you know how to fix them, and you know what the valuation impact is on these.
Thank you. Is it the case that in some companies, they appear to be incredibly profitable, but upon looking really deeply, they are not as profitable as the founders may think? And if that's the case, what numbers or what aspects are those founders missing?
They could be profitable 1 year, but they might have put off certain expenses for the next year. They might not be spending money to get ready for higher, let's say if they have a tax issue and they know it's coming, but that they want to raise money this year, that they'll put that off. That's why this due diligence is so critical, that people are going to look for items that are not on the balance sheet. They're going to look for items that are not on the P&L statement. So it's those things where, you know, someone's going to know, oh, okay, by the way, you've had these employees for 5 years and you're not paying them very well and you're giving them stock. Eventually, that won't be the case anymore. And you're going to have to start paying people more because there's not enough stock to give away anymore. Because you've already given a chunk of stock away, but now you need higher level people to keep what you're doing on the rise. And how does that work? And that's why they start looking at your 3 to 5 year forecast. And they'll dig into that as well. And they'll start asking, why, where's this number come from? Where's this number come from? Why didn't you add this number, this percentage to this? Because this is what will happen. Or I think that's the case where, yes, in the current year, they're still making money, but they deferred a lot of expenses, and maybe through some aggressive accounting, they recognize income where maybe they shouldn't.
Thank you. How can entrepreneurs prepare for the impact of AI on profitability? Because I saw the case study that you mentioned on your LinkedIn about the company called Square, that one day they were talking about how profitable they were, and the next day they laid off 4,000 staff. And I'm wondering about how an entrepreneur can forecast their profitability and considering the impact of AI on their business.
So with Square, what I said there was this, they're profitable, but they made a strategic decision to lay people off because they think AI is going to take their jobs. So let's announce a layoff. We'll take the hit on our stock. If it was it, I'm not sure. But it's going to impact people, AI. And if you're ahead of the curve, it's going to make you look better for an investor. So by saying, okay, I have this type of staff, I have these type of people, will keeping the level of staffing the same, but we'll just put a lot of money into AI and we'll make everybody smarter, better, more efficient. And then, so that's the core staff. And then as you grow, we might not need to add people. because everybody's is more efficient, more effective. And as people leave, you might not have to rehire for that slot. I don't know if that answered the question.
Yes. What tools or processes are non-negotiable for scaling companies?
It's having strategic information so you can make strategic decisions. If you're scaling, you need information that's correct and timely. And it's like, if you're scaling, unfortunately, sometimes you have to take a chance. There's always that. And you have to prepare if it doesn't work out. What's plan B? I think that's really critical too. A lot of companies, they get to that next level because they took the chance, but they plan for it. They understand that plan A, plan B, and if it doesn't work within 2 to 3 months, let's cut the cord and move on to our next chance or our next opportunity. I think that's really important to also. You got to take a chance. Because it's a new company and you want to be out there and do things that no one else is doing, but no one to say, okay, we tried it, it didn't work. Let's preserve our assets so we could roll that into something else and try that.
Thank you. Please give us three case studies of companies you've either helped with their growth and tell us what kind of measures you put in place. You don't have to mention the company necessarily. And if you don't have those kind of three case studies, perhaps tell us some three case studies of companies you've seen make really big mistakes that you would never do.
So back in my youth, a while back, I took a company that spun out of Salomon Brothers or Viper Energy, which was analogous to Goldman Sachs. And we started there with a checkbook. We were one of the largest sellers of platinum group metals, platinum, palladium, rhodium, going into catalytic converters in the United States. We started with metal, a couple $1 million in the bank, but we had no infrastructure at all. We had a checkbook. When we left, we had to get going quick. And that was great for me because I was young and I was CFO of a $500 million company, but we had no infrastructure. So what we did was scale quick. And I hired the right people. I hired Ernst & Young as our auditor. I hired lawyers. I hired IT people, the people I could trust to do it. So that's one. And then when we were up and going, we were selling to GM, Chrysler, Ford, Mitsubishi. We traded on Wall Street. Everything we did had to be perfect every time. If we were selling metal, we sent it a day early. If we were paying people, we paid them a day early. We were a new company and we had to have zero operational issues. There was only one standard, and that way of thinking went from the top to the bottom of the organization. And that's one way of building value. Another company I worked with, I was the CFO of a private equity firm, and we acquired a sizable position of a technology company. And where they needed our help was with building a reporting mechanism for their marketing team, because the marketing team didn't have the information that they needed. They didn't know who the key contacts were in their industry on an easy basis. And so we invested in that. And because they had better information, they were able to do better sales, have more productive meetings and conferences. And that really energized what they did. We got out of there with an 8 to 10x return, just by putting money into their marketing and sales. Another small company I worked with, it was a cannabis company where they wanted to build a cannabis sales organization. throughout the world. And what we had to do there was to look at where you can buy a cannabis plantation outside the US and where you could ship it throughout the world. And by doing that, we supported them with legal work, shipping work, insurance for the cannabis. And within 3 or 4 years, we turned it around and we got out with a 10 to 12x return. Because in the United States, they never opened up the market for us. So we had when we purchased the company, that's what we were really looking for. But it never came. So we really had to pivot and say, okay, how are we going to get our money back and how are we going to make money? Let's look at the international market. And that's what we did. Although I'm a finance person, a good finance person also thinks strategically. And that's really the difference between us, a good CFO and a controller. And that's another thing people have to really understand the difference of that.
Thank you. What's the difference between an accountant and a CFO?
An accountant in certain circumstances doesn't have the experience of a CFO, because the accountant's head down, just putting in numbers, making sure things balance, making sure that every transaction is well documented, making sure that every transaction is approved before money leaves the company or before certain entries or allocations are approved. A CFO is strategic, is looking towards the future of the company and making sure that they have the internal controls, policies, and procedures to make that happen on a consistent basis. And the CFO needs to be able to tell management, the board, investors, maybe the bank, the truth, because they see things from a different vantage point, because they're not in a lot of the commercial meetings, but they're seeing the numbers and they need to understand where the numbers are coming from and why there might be an issue. Maybe there won't be an issue, you don't know, but that person, whoever the CFO is, he or she needs to have the backbone to look the people in the eye and say, I think there might be an issue here. Let's investigate it. That's one of the big, and a lot of accountants could grow up to be a CFO. It's time and learning and experience that will get you there.
Thank you. What red flags instantly turn investors off?
Number one are losses that can't be explained. Number two is a high level of legal expenses for reasons that aren't positive, such as employee lawsuits. Another area is you're not hitting your targets, because they're going to ask you, how much did you make this year? What was your plan? If you're not hitting your plan, why not? And then you start asking the questions like, did you know you weren't going to hit your plan 3 months in, 6 months in? How did you alter your plan? What did you do to help the cause? And they stare at them like they have no answer, because no one sat down with them and said, you have an issue here. We have to change something. And so, yes, they still might close the deal, but it's going to be a significant discount, because once they come in, that they're going to come in, the new investors, and put all these things in place. And they'll, as you said, they're very smart when they buy. They like buying at steep discounts. That's what they look for. Or they start looking at, as I said before, insurance issues, their risk management here. Are there issues that we don't know about? And is there insurance to cover these things? If there's not, that adds even more risk and another hit to your valuation.
Thank you. How do entrepreneurs act differently when building for profitability versus building for exit?
I think someone who's looking for profitability might be just looking for growth and looking to cut expenses as much as possible and not really caring about the future, let's say. Whereas someone who's looking for an exit is looking for growth as well, but they also don't want to get involved in the whole valuation issue where, you know, I use this example. So let's say someone has free cash flow of $1 million a year, hypothetically. And so they think their business is worth 10 times free cash flow or EBITDA, right? So they go through the whole due diligence and the VC firm or the PE firm or the family office says, you know what? You're not worth 10x. You're worth 6x because you have a couple of issues. And one is your accounting infrastructure, let's say. And I say, if you spent $100,000, which you could afford if you have $1 million free cash flow, in cleaning up your infrastructure and view this as an investment, not as an expense, you spent $100,000. And let's say you could get back two of those on the discount. Instead of 6x, you're getting 8x. So you just made $2 million on a $100,000 investment. That's a 20x return. You should be doing that every day. And that's what I try to explain to entrepreneurs and founders when they're getting ready to sell or do a material transaction, a material financial transaction. This is what's going to increase your value from within.
Thank you. What's one financial habit that dramatically increases company value over time?
Not wasting money. If you're going to spend money, do the due diligence on the vendor. Do the go out and get a couple of bids or estimates. Yes, you should be spending money to grow. And yes, all these expenses are needed in investments in your business, but you can't waste money by being quick on the trigger or going with a buddy, or it's business and you have to do what's best. And then once you get the business or once you sign the contract, you have to manage that group. You can't expect them to do a great job all the time. You have to spend time with them and get updates within your contract. Put in, we'll get bi-weekly, monthly updates or whatever it is. And ask them the hard questions, because if they're doing something that you don't have experience with, which makes sense if you're a new entrepreneur, but now you have somebody who could give you experience in what you need. So take the time and allocate your time or somebody in your company's time to learn what that person is doing and to really understand. And so then you might be able to give them more information, so their process or their contract is even more valuable to you.
Thank you. What role does predictability in revenue play in valuation? And what can a company do to increase the likelihood of the revenue continuing to remain predictable?
Predictable revenue is critical to valuation. It's also better if it's predictable and increasing, if it keeps going up. And you need to then now have the story or the proof that we're doing what we need to do to keep improving our revenue stream. And that goes to planning, having the proper people in sales and marketing, have a strategic plan just for marketing and sales that makes sense, that you've gone out to your clients and asked them, what are you going to need in the next 12 months? Where are we falling short? How can we improve what we're doing? What aren't we doing that would really improve your business and really create this partnership with your clients? Because just remember, when they do due diligence, they're going to be calling your clients also, and they're going to get that feedback as well.
Thank you. How can entrepreneurs connect with you?
A couple of ways. One through LinkedIn. So Jeffrey Glick, CPA. My email is jeffrey@ocfo.com. That's the company I work for. And, or they could ask you and you could give them my information. But yeah, so Jeffrey Glick on LinkedIn or jeffrey@ocfo.com. Outsource CFO. That's what it stands for.
Follow us for more interviews with world's most influential business titans, providing you with the insights to awaken to your full potential so you can get paid to be yourself, find true happiness, and manifest anything you desire.